Welcome back to the Make or Break Show, where each week we bring you stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with artist and craftsman Yuri Tuckman. We get into how Yuri is combining his fine art background with practical engineering skills to create finished pieces full of whimsy. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. We have another fun one for you, as always. This week, we are throwing it across the Atlantic, and we are chatting with a European, the one and only Yuri Tuckman, who is doing some insane engravings and just really cool sculptures that are really, really fun. But before we get into our chat with Yuri, as always, first and foremost, thank you so much to all the support you guys have given the show over the years, and specifically, thank you so much to the awesome supporters over on Patreon. I wanted to give a quick shout out to those supporters and a brand new one as of this week. This is coming in from Rex Kruger. So thank you so much for that. And also to the Shop Class, Wills and Things, Stian Sorhus, Making at Home, Steve Mosley, Winston Moy, Jedediah Schultz, and JW Craftsman. Thank you so much for all of your support. I could not do this without you guys. So this week we are chatting with Yuri, and I first came across Yuri's stuff. So there was a big maker event called Maker Central that was happening in England just a few weekends back. And so a lot of folks from past guests on this show were there, like Bob Claggett, Jimmy Diresta, and ZH Fabrications, and a bunch of other guys. And there was a really cool European group as well. So a few folks that we've had on before, like Jacko, whatever. But I saw that Yuri was going to be there, and I'd seen Yuri's stuff a few times before. But he does these really intricate metal engravings, and he does these cool custom sculptures. They're kind of hard to describe. His stuff is just really cool. But he's got this one that is a backward scissor that he created. And what's funny about it is if you actually squeeze down on the scissors, it would cut your hand. And so he does these kind of wild out there sculptures, but they look amazing. He's got a fine art background, and he's just doing really, really cool stuff. And he gives you a lot of ways to actually make your own tools to do some of the stuff that he's doing, especially on the hand carving side of things. So he was a blast to chat with, and I know you guys are going to enjoy this interview with Yuri. And before we get into that, I'll let you guys know that at the beginning we had a little bit of audio issue, so you might hear a little bit of a rustle on his end, and I tried to clean that up as best as I could, but after a few minutes or so that gets cleaned up as well. But without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Yuri. All right, guys, welcome back to the Make or Break Show. We're hanging out with Yuri Tuckman today, calling in from Berlin, Germany. Not a master engraver, but I feel like in our community, we would call you a master engraver because you're doing some pretty incredible stuff. But man, thank you so much for jumping on and chatting with us. Real excited to see what you're doing and hear about your story.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's very exciting. I like it.
Yeah. So I had, so I was looking around on your site, and it looks like, do you have a formal art background? Is that kind of where you came?
Yeah, you can. I studied art in a university.
Okay.
For 4 years. Yeah.
Where where'd you get a school?
So it's called the Bezalel School of Fine Arts in it's in Jerusalem.
Okay.
It's a pretty big university, and I had a very fine time there. It's a good school, absolutely.
Is that when you were growing up? Were you just drawing and painting? Like, how'd you kind of get into art?
Good question. I mean, I always drew and painted when I was younger, but I mean, I assume everybody does in a way. But yeah, I would say, I mean, I liked it more than others, kind of. But really, I started hitting it off with the whole art thing in category, like art category and all of that, when I was in high school and I just got oil paints for my sister. And I started painting with oil paints, and that's where really I got into that. And I decided I want to continue, you know, studying art and working in the art field and stuff like that.
Did was there any like subject that really interested you to start out, or was it just kind of everything?
I think, and it's also, you can see that today, I always had the kind of the, I always wanted to make things or to have those things that I see wherever.
Yeah.
So I wanted to have a snooker table. So I decided the best thing I can do is to build one. And I always wanted to be or to have specific things. And to be, I mean, I always want to be like an engineer or inventor or a pilot. Doesn't matter. So I create, when I had a thing in my mind, I created the whole world to try and make this somewhat a reality. So this is really where art came in and yeah, made it happen.
What type of table? What did you say that was?
A snooker table, like a billiard table.
A billiard table. Okay, gotcha. So
yeah, snooker is like the British.
Really, I didn't know there's a, I didn't know there's a different name for it. I thought that was just in German. That's wild. So you like, had you done any like woodworking or construction, or like was that? Did you kind of go straight into it?
I always tried woodworking. Like I said, around high school, I started to really try to make things. Didn't study. There were in my high school, there wasn't really a workshop or anything like that. So I had to work with what I had, and I bought some tools in the hardware store. But when I really got to woodworking is when I started in the art university, and there they had an amazing workshop, like huge workshop, and I literally spent most of my time just working there and building things, basically.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you built?
In art school, in art university?
Yeah, yeah. Or what was your focus in art school?
Ooh, yeah, that's, I think I would say I didn't have any focus. I really like to create a sort of room. So for my second year, I again made a billiard table.
Okay.
Because I really liked making those. Well, I made it was the second one, but I really wanted to make another one. And it was kind of a lounge type of deal. So all the paintings were kind of hung flat on the wall, meaning that they were like shelves that you could put glasses on. And, you know, it's a contemporary art school. So things were kind of like pretty difficult to put it in the words quickly. But basically, I made later on also a craps table, like in a casino, which is kind of similar. But my final exhibition, I made all sorts of like electric violins, some cases, wooden long cases look funky, all sorts of brochures. And yeah, I mean, I had the pigeon book, which is later on nowadays is my kind of logo thing. So yeah, it's everything. It's hard to give one word, but yeah. That's basically what I've done.
Yeah, when I've talked with other folks that went to art school, I feel like some people, there's like some of their projects, like they're trying to express some feeling or some thought, or they want to communicate something. And other people, they just want to make cool stuff. Like when you were making your billiard table, your craps table, like was there a bigger purpose? Like were you trying to like have just a bigger piece to it? Or was it more of kind of the process of putting it together?
So that's one of the things. It's kind of tricky because it, like I said, it's a contemporary art school,
right.
You need to be very critical about whatever it is you're doing and why you're doing it. So every exhibition you have a critique with like five or six tutors or teachers and other students, and you have half an hour to communicate and talk about why you made this. And so yeah, you get pretty deep. It gets pretty crazy. Contemporary art is like you get sucked into this world where it's never-ending process of thinking. So the snooker table, this one actually particularly was a billiard table or a pool table. And it was made out of the cheapest wood I can find. But the table itself tried to be very royal and nice looking. So
yeah.
I didn't have I didn't use a lathe to make the legs, but instead I've cut many type shapes, discs, and stacked them up together to make look like a nice flowing leg.
Yeah.
So there was a lot. So this was second year. So it was more of a, how should I say it? A beginner's contemporary art thing where you talk about differences of high of classes,
yeah,
differences of material, cheap material versus very expensive material. So yeah, that was, I guess, the deeper meaning of it all. But I actually wanted to make a billiard table.
Do you still have it?
No, it's in the garbage.
It's in the garbage. So did you...
I've done way too much.
Yeah. So the engraving, especially on metal, did that start in university? Like, were you doing that for embellishments?
No. During art university, I was starting to be more and more, attracted to Renaissance and Baroque and all of this kind of stuff. But I was very, very tamed in this sense because it was contemporary art. So everything was dealt in kind of a look from modernistic perspective or contemporary perspective. And I think it still applies for what I do today, but today I've kind of managed to free myself from the Bezalel way of thinking, and I'm doing lots of air quotes, sorry. But I started engraving, like my first video that I've done on YouTube was my second engraving project.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I started like a year and a half ago, maybe close to 2 years.
So what would you do between university, or when would you get out of university?
Maybe 7-8 years ago.
Oh, wow,
maybe?
So a while, yeah. What would you do? What'd you do right after?
Right after, I tried to be an artist, but that's very difficult.
Yeah.
And especially where I lived in Jerusalem, then I moved to Tel Aviv. So you need money, and you don't have money very easily either.
Yeah.
So you need to work a lot. So I started working in a coffee place, in a bar/coffee place. And then at some point, me and my friend, we owned kind of the place, and we opened another place in Tel Aviv. So I was really sucked in the restaurant business.
Oh, really?
Okay. I had no time at all for art, and I was kind of suffering. And at some point, I decided I would move to Berlin, and that kind of was a good decision.
Yeah. Where are you from originally?
From Jerusalem.
Oh, you're from Jerusalem. Okay, gotcha. For some reason, I was like, I don't think he's German, but he's in Berlin or something. So, okay, that makes, gotcha, that makes more sense.
That's actually confusing, yeah, because German and Hebrew accent are somewhat similar.
Okay.
Because German and Hebrew accents are kind of, they overpronounce the word. It's very, everything's very, you have lots of stops between letters and between words.
Yeah.
Everything is overpronounced. And so it can be similar, but it's not exactly right.
Gotcha. I took a little bit of Hebrew. And so when you pronounce your last name, I'm like, I guess that's German, but that sounds more like what I heard in class. So that's crazy.
It is actually German, Tuchman.
But I am, so I'm just completely wrong. So you're German ancestry, and you grew up in Israel, and then you moved back to Germany?
Yeah, so my grandmother, grandparents are from Germany. Then they moved to Israel when things went south.
Yep.
And then, now I kind of came back.
Got it. Okay, so I'm just all confused, but that's crazy. You got a lot of interesting, I guess, like exposures, because I'm imagining, like, how has growing up in Israel influenced, like, your work now? Like, is there stuff you've learned there that's maybe not traditional, like, Western European stuff?
I'm sure. Well, making art in Israel is very difficult because if you were to make what I make back in Israel, then you can possibly be categorized as an escapist in a way, because you escape the reality of which is Israel. Right?
Yeah.
So in a sense, everything you make is political, because if it's apolitical, then it's escapistic, and therefore I'm making the statement of ignoring the politics, right?
Right.
So this is pretty difficult on art making, because you're obliged to have a say in what's happening, whether it's very straightforward or whether it's around or something like that.
Yeah. So what were you trying to communicate? Since it sounds like you didn't want to make a political statement.
In the products that I make now, you mean?
No, but when you were when you were in Israel.
So when I was in Israel, no, I still didn't make things that really had nothing to do well, directly with what's happening in the country and all of that. But I think also under inside the frame of the school, you had a little bit more leeway to do your own thing. So not everything was judged through the lens of politics, but definitely I was, in a way, out of place slightly.
Yeah.
I was a bit out of place because I would say that, and it's again, the contemporary art is Italian, but it's like my art pieces could have been very, very non-Israeli, which made them Israeli in a sense, because
right.
It's like, look at this guy dreaming, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Or yeah, yeah.
How this guy fantasizes a different culture, or is it his culture? It's all mixed. And also all of my art pieces are very, very mixed. And you can say that also has a big reflection to Israeli society, because the only thing connects everybody is that they're Jewish. But aside from that, everybody comes from all over the world, right?
Really? Okay.
So yeah, you always can get connections because they are in your subconscious, right? So I don't know.
So before getting into more of the stuff you're doing now, so you said you opened a restaurant?
Yeah, we were four partners basically.
Okay.
And me and my friend, we were smaller partners. We opened a place in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
And I was like the chef, so I was responsible for the cooking and all of that.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it was fun, but it's like working all day, every day.
Yeah. 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 Did you have an experience like in the culinary world, or did you just jump into it?
I don't know. I started cooking in a kibbutz.
Okay.
You know what a kibbutz? Oh, no, should I explain? It's like kind of a social town. Kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead and explain it. Yeah, that'd be good if people know.
All right. And so during my national service, in a way, I went, we as a group, it's kind of a movement. In Israel, everybody goes through kind of a movement. Normally, it's a socialist movement because it's very fitting to Israel, all everything that goes on and that. So you, what you do is you go to a kibbutz, you work there, and then you go to the military and all of that.
Got it.
So during the kibbutz, I started cooking. Yeah, I worked in the kitchen, which is like for 600 people. And yeah, this is the start of my experience in cooking, I suppose.
Gotcha. How long did you guys have a restaurant?
So the restaurant we opened, I actually stayed there for 1 year and then I moved to Berlin.
Gotcha. And then what brought you back or brought you to Berlin?
So I always wanted to go to Berlin. And also, my wife is German.
Got it. That's a good reason. Is your family close?
My family is still back in Jerusalem.
Gotcha. What about your wife?
She's from here, from Germany, and yeah.
Gotcha. That's
her family.
So, getting into more of what you're doing now, is this, first off, is this like your full time deal? Is this your like day job, or are you doing this on the side?
Yeah, it takes the longest amount of time for my day. I do make some design works on the side and all sorts of things like that. But so I don't have a 9-to-5 job or anything like this. So aside from that, you can say freelancer. But yeah, the YouTube is, I could have took it upon myself, and it's like, every day, many hours a day. Yeah.
So what made you decide to start posting your projects, like, in, because I know you've been sharing them, but in terms of like the video format?
So it started from realizing that trying to succeed in the art field, in the contemporary art world, is the worst thing for me. I truly hate it. I don't enjoy it whatsoever. I still want to do it. I still want to integrate in this world somehow. But basically, if you want to succeed in the art field, you need to be a seller. You need to be very good at marketing. And your art is like, whatever, doesn't really matter that much. So it's all about mingling, finding yourself in the right circles, knowing how to talk, knowing how to do all of that. And I felt like if I suffer doing that so much, I will be really bad doing it. And then I started thinking, because I started watching YouTube videos and I started loving it, and I started learning amazing things from YouTube that I didn't learn from university. Because in university, they don't really teach you a lot of techniques.
Yeah.
It's more about to be critical. And I thought, like, you know, if I share my own stuff, if I upload videos, I'm, you know, the king of my castle. I can control how much effort I can put into this, how good the product, and then it's out there. Everybody can see it. And with the outfield, you make art for nobody, and then you hope that maybe you talk to the right person. He's like, okay, show me your stuff, right? But in YouTube, I can just like, hey, everybody can see it now. And if it's good, it's good. And if it's not good, then maybe it's not good. You know what I mean?
Is YouTube kind of like a massive art gallery for you? Like, do you approach it kind of the same way? Like, you put up your projects kind of like...
No, it's the exact opposite.
Exact opposite. Okay, got you. How's that?
Because YouTube, that's the beautiful thing about YouTube. YouTube has... I mean, it has some politics, but it has almost zero politics when in comparison to galleries.
Got it.
Because on YouTube, everybody can be anything, right? You put your stuff, if people like it, it succeeds. Obviously, yeah, you have algorithms and all of that, but when it comes to it all, if the video is great and you keep doing that, nothing can stop you. With the galleries, it's just, okay, the curator is like, okay, I want this guy to be this and that. So I will take his pieces, whatever. Not whatever. Obviously, there's a lot of thought goes to everything there. But it's so complex and it's so evolved around who knows who and who knows what and money and all of that stuff, which is the amount of effort you put in your artwork, the amount of effort you put in your work or the passion you have has nothing to do with how successful you'll be in the art field.
Got it.
Almost nothing to do with it. I mean, it has something to do. And, you know, there are cases where artists just do their own art and some curator picked them up and now they're like... a huge success,
right?
But this doesn't work this way. No, yeah. Not really.
Yeah. So it was just a way to share what you were working on without having to worry. There's no gatekeepers. So you're just
going to
share. So why the whole process, like the video piece, like versus just sharing your work? I know you shared Instagram, but it's a lot. I imagine it takes a long time to make what you're making, but then it also takes a long time to record it and edit it and post it and all that kind of stuff.
I think the videos, they kind of transformed the whole idea of the art pieces. The YouTube is part of the art piece itself. You know, it's not only the end product. It's totally about the journey and totally about how I do I work and how I interact with things and how, you know, between videos I interact with other people and how it influences and all this entire world becomes the art piece itself and the magic of sharing everything. And that's, yeah, absolutely. It's a completely different way to make art in a way. And I love it.
That's really interesting. I had, I've listened to, Bob Claggett with I Like to Make Stuff, who was at Baker Central. Wow, sorry. My brain is not working today. And then like Jimmy DiResta, they have a podcast called Making It.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of times they'll talk about how their end product isn't what they're making, but it's the video. Like really they're creating the videos because that's kind of what the piece they're communicating to the world. So does that influence what you're making then? Like, do you make decisions about the piece you're working on in light of the fact that you're making a video or you're recording the process? Like, does that change anything?
No, now that I wanted to say no, but now that I think about it, absolutely yes. So in a way, I have the idea and I want to work on it and I document it, okay? But the videos themselves have a huge influence on what I do. So ever since I started making videos about what I do, I'm a gazillion times more productive. I make an art piece every 2 weeks or so. And before that, I could have made one art piece for, I don't know, like 3 months or half a year.
Yeah.
Right? It gets really like smooshed. And, no, it completely transformed what I do. And that's the real amazing thing, that I couldn't have imagined doing this kind of stuff if I didn't record it and shared it. And it absolutely is a different way of thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
So
I don't know. It's complicated, but yeah.
Yeah, so do you shoot for then a project every couple of weeks, you said?
Every couple of weeks I try to make a new video and have a new artist, yeah.
Okay, so I want to get into what you're making. So you said the engraving, that was basically the first time you did it, and that was about a year ago that you started?
A year and a half, I would say, yeah.
So how did... why did you decide to get into it?
I try to remember. Because I wanted to have the ability to make something, something that is ornamented, okay. You know? And when it comes to metal, that's kind of the way to go. You can, there are a repoussé where you hit the metal and kind of smoosh it, but engraving is the more sharpest one, and I absolutely... I wanted to make a piece, and I thought, how can I take every part of this piece and make it the best thing it could be, basically?
Yeah.
And engraving started there.
Was the marking gauge, was that the reason you wanted, that was the piece you wanted to be amazing at all levels, or was it something else that you started with?
I cannot remember. I think I had a few ideas already at this point. No, this wasn't the first thing. I had weirdly enough, the first video that I wanted to make was an invention called the gold reduction, I called it.
Okay.
And I still haven't done it. I'm still waiting. I still need to make it. And that will be, I think, a great piece. And this was the first thing I wanted to make, every little piece, something incredible. So they are kind of a metal hands, like in a watch or a clock. And they are engraved, and underneath that there is like a piece of leather or something like that. And on the side there is wood with wooden inlays.
Yeah.
So everything is like kind of a extravaganza of ornaments and stuff. Yeah.
And you've got, so there's pictures of that on your website, the gold reduction, right?
Yeah, that was kind of I would call it a prototype.
Prototype, okay.
So,
Dear Lord, that thing looks amazing. What does that do?
So that is you put two pens or pencils at each point.
Okay.
And basically, when you move one of them, the other one is reduced by the golden ratio.
Oh, cool!
And
yes,
it throws it just either smaller or bigger. It depends what you move.
Is that how you get those crazy designs that people will post sometimes?
It's kind of similar to the one with the cogs. I forgot how it's named. You turn it around and you got, it's also about reduction. Yeah, absolutely.
That's
so very similar.
That's really neat. So is your workspace then, am I seeing that behind you? Do you have a massive workspace you're working with?
No, that's my living room.
That's crazy. Cause,
so that's the only, yeah.
Because most of your stuff is fairly small, right? Relatively.
Yeah.
Okay. Is everything pretty much hand powered? Do you use any power tools or anything like that?
I have a drill.
Okay.
Not a drill. How would you call it? Screwdriver.
Yeah. Just power drill. Yeah.
Power drill. Yeah.
When I was watching your, I guess it was probably your hammer, engraved hammer, was the first video that I saw, and so I was assuming that you were about to forge it, and I was about to see a lot of blacksmithing stuff, and then you were then you cut it down from the stock just with hand tools. I'm like, I didn't even know you could do that, but I guess that makes sense. That's so cool what you could do. So when you first started posting your videos, was there a point when you realized people were watching it and liking it?
Yeah, I mean, I got, people were very positive.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning. I didn't get a lot of views or anything. I got most of my views from Reddit. People posted on Reddit, shared it on Reddit, and I got most of the views from there, I think, in the beginning. And weirdly enough, on Reddit, people were much harsher.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're mean.
They were more like, okay, this is technical stuff now.
Yeah.
So much harsher. So, but then, all in all, people were, I find it really surprising how positive people are. I'm waiting, like, you get some bad comments every once in a while, but I was expecting to, you know, this is the first time I really exposed myself on the internet, and I thought, like, okay, this is time to get to grow a thick skin.
Yeah.
But in reality, it wasn't that.
People
are incredible, really.
Yeah, is it weird to see so many people watching what you're making and liking what you're making and then interacting with you?
It's points where you realize the number, because you don't realize it all the time. You don't understand the capacity, like the amount of people that watch the videos and what does it mean, because you still just see a number. And I think every once in a while you start thinking about it and it was like, wow, that's really like, that's a lot of people. And
right. And
all the people write comments and they like it so much and they try their own engraving and things like that, and it's hard to comprehend in a way. And then I think in Maker Central, this was a very surreal experience for me, because that's when I realized, like, man, like, people come and like, hey, can I take a picture and all of that, and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like, I mean, I just, you know, I'm just making stuff and it's on the internet.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, that's kind of when I started realizing that, there's a lot of people.
Did you go to Maker Central last year, or was this your first year going?
My first year.
This
year.
Did you give a talker, or did you just go to attend?
I had a presentation on the stage, on the main stage.
Okay.
About engraving. I was very nervous, but it was a lot of fun. It was really good.
Yeah. I had, so Alex Steele, on as a blacksmith on YouTube. And so he's in the States now, but he said last year was his first time like being around people that had watched his stuff, and he had that same kind of, sounds like, experience you did. Like, it's cool to see the numbers, but then when you actually meet people in person, you're like, oh, this is wild. So your projects, I'm trying to figure out how I would even describe them to people, other than the fact they're just like, they're like whimsical. Like, it's almost like if you just had like a quick glance at it, you're like, oh, that's something like neat he's reproducing out of like the Renaissance or something. But then, like, I'm looking at your backward scissors and you're like, wait a minute, like, there's something else going on. Has that kind of like quirky, like in a good way? Have you always enjoyed that type of stuff?
I think I always had the ideas. Not exactly the ideas, the way of thinking.
Yeah.
But I never had the capabilities of actually making it.
Right, right.
Until I got to YouTube. And when I got to YouTube and I see people like Jimmy DiResta and I see people like Clickspring, and I'm like, there's nothing stopping me from doing that. I can just sit on the table and start working with files and songs and whatnot. And so it's like, how about I make backward scissors? It's ludicrous, but if I make it, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I can just make it.
Where did the idea for that come from? Was it literally just like that, I want to make backward scissors?
I don't know. The process of coming up with ideas is very fluid.
Okay.
And usually I come up with ideas when I work on something different, right? So with the scissors... my first project that I tried to do engraving were scissors. So I made scissors, just normal scissors from brass.
Yeah.
And I tried engraving them and something like that. And then I left it aside, and I just like really like the shape of scissors. They have a very unique shape, and I like their aesthetics. And I was like, okay, I want to make another pair of scissors. I feel like it's a really cool shape. I feel like, you know, like making knives is cool, but I'm not really, even though I made a knife, like a kind of a Japanese chef knife, I was thought like knife is, lots of people are making it much better than I could ever make in a way. So I was like, I want something that is mine in a way. So, and I like the idea of scissors. And then I thought, you know what, but again, take it a bit, how far can I take this? Because just the scissors is not enough. So I don't know. Then at this point, I was like, how can I make them useless in a way? and that's where I got to the backward scissors, I think. And I really want to revisit this to make it much more proper and more scary. Not scary, but more dangerous, I suppose, in a way. Because the ones that I made are not up to blade making standards.
Got it. Because it took me a second when I first saw them to realize like what would happen, like especially in that thumbnail, like what would happen if you squeeze your hands. I'm like, oh, he's going to cut his thumb off. That's really funny. that's cool. And then what about so another one that I think really stands out is the handshake handsaw, which is hilarious. Where did that idea come from?
Where did that come from? So I have many works that has things with hands.
Yeah.
I think that comes from when I sculpt something, I like it to be one to one. And if I want to work on something relatively small, a hand is like the perfect. It has like very very interesting and dynamic shape, and it's just nice to sculpt. It's very intricate and it's very has a chiastic movement to it, and so I always get attracted to making hands. So I don't remember what came first. Either I wanted to make a saw, and the handshake handle came to mind, or I wanted to make a project with a hand, and that came to mind. So I'm actually don't remember exactly, but I'm just looking back because I'm trying to look at it to see. To try to remind myself how did I come to this idea, but I don't remember exactly.
And if people aren't familiar, I'll definitely include a link, but it's for folks that are listening, I mean, it's literally a hand that you hold that's like a handshake with a saw. Have you ever actually used it as a saw?
A little bit. The problem is that you kind of hold it pretty far back from the blade.
Oh, gotcha.
So the blade tends to flex
okay.
a little bit, yeah. So it's not the best thing.
Yeah. So you've got a lot of stuff that's kind of definitely sculpting. Did you learn that skill in university, or has that just been something you've kind of learned as you've gone?
I would definitely say that in university I didn't learn it.
Okay.
But when you work a lot with three-dimensional shapes, you work a lot with painting, shading, and all of the stuff, so perhaps develop kind of a way to look at three-dimensional objects. But wood carving, I haven't done much or at all. I've done some sculpting with clay that I really enjoy, but I definitely need to sculpt more because it's really, really fun. I would say, no, I didn't do much carving. I didn't learn much of it, but I think. And I like how they came out, the carvings that I do, but they take way longer if I were to be really good at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just take a lot of time to try at least.
Yeah. I drew and painted a ton in school. And so I've done a lot of like 2D stuff and like he's doing like digital painting and whatnot. But I was working on a project this morning that was my first time ever trying to sculpt anything out of wood or carve out of wood. And I kept catching myself. I'm like, I would look at it and I'm like, oh shoot, if I don't turn this real quick, this thing is going to be so lopsided. So for me, it's been like a definitely interesting to get my head, literally head around the fact this is like a full three-dimensional shape. But yeah, it's so much fun. It's crazy.
It's really fun. And I'll tell you what, there is like two really, really crucial tips that I can give okay. for carving or for sculpting.
Yeah.
Is that first, sculpt with clay, because you can work, you can erase and
yes.
add.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So we're carving, and stone carvers, like, I think always, if you make really big stuff or even smaller stuff, but like really complex shapes, they always do a clay sculpture first and then copy that to the stone.
Really? Okay.
They don't just go blind.
Yeah.
Most maybe there's like super virtuous people that can make a Michelangelo with like whatever, just like start carving. And the second thing is that I forgot completely. What was it? Oh man, that, but this was the important one. No, I forgot.
No worries. No worries. Yeah, the doing it with clay makes a ton of sense. I cut off too much and I was like, dang it, like there's, I could glue this, I guess, but it's going to look ridiculous. So I'm like, well, I guess the whole thing is going to be just a little bit smaller now, but.
I remember. The second thing is the black canvas syndrome. That's a very important one. And this is something that you always suffer with painting, sculpting, everything, is that the art piece looks really bad. So you're rushing to try to complete it as fast as you can. So it will look good, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because in the beginning, it looks bad. It looks really, really bad. And like you're starting to lose motivation and you start to be lazy and carve really quickly and not putting a lot of focus in details. And so that's how, and that's the point where the more you carve, the more you become masterful of the work, the more you have the confidence that it will look good in the end,
yeah.
but at the moment it looks really bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I would definitely catch myself drawing, like I would get the form down and then do like a ton of detail in one spot just to see, like, is this going to even look cool to give me motivation to keep going? But yeah, right. I tried to do that a little bit even this morning, and I was like, ah, crap! Like this was a bad idea. But it's a lot of fun. So on the engraving side, you put together a really fun video on making a starter kit for engraving. And I think what's crazy that I didn't realize, do you make the majority of your tools?
To engrave? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I wish I could make the vise. But
right.
For that, actually, you need to have a proper vise, because that if it's a little bit shaky and if it's a little bit lopsided and or crooked and all of that, that really damages not only your experience, but that really damages your muscle memory.
Yeah.
Because then you start developing muscle memory that tries to fix the problems with the vise. That's a bad thing. But engravers, or gravers, I should say, like the chisels, I feel like you can... if you do a Western-style engraving, which what I do mostly, so if you just buy a 90 degrees graver, you'll be probably fine. But... once you learn to make your own graver, first of all, you lose the fear of that you don't have kind of a confident relationship with the graver, because you didn't. If you make your own graver, you know it from back to front. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
And it's not like this precious thing that
right.
is far from you, and you need to treat it kind of like as a separate piece. And if you make your own gravers, you have complete control on what it's going to do. And once you develop a skill to do that, which it's crazy to call it a skill because it's so simple to make your own graver, that the benefits are immediate. And once you start doing that, you start getting a lot of chisels for specific tasks, I would say.
Where do you buy your steel for the actual carving section?
So either online or the local art shop that has spring steel.
Okay.
But now I'm looking into, I want to try some more Japanese engraving, more Japanese style engraving. So these are actually really difficult to find chisels that are fitting for this kind of purpose. Obviously, you can just use tool steel, like O1 steel, whatever. It will work just fine. But I have found a company, so I'm going to buy some blanks that are just literally pieces of metal that are hand forged or whatever. They're really cheap. They're like $4 a piece. Okay. And then start shaping them.
What's the difference with Japanese engraving versus what you do?
So Japanese engraving, you engrave backwards towards yourself, towards your stomach. And Japanese engraving, they have... So Western engraving kind of developed this standardized scroll work. So everything is very geometrically sound.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of deviation between styles. Like you have three major styles, like German, English, and American. And basically you do those styles with your take on it. So it's very subtle. But where Japanese engraving, I think in also the name that they use for engraving, they use just carving, because literally they carve the metal. And so you have, it's more about much more, I would say realistic, but more, it's not scroll work, basically.
Yeah.
It's not scroll work, it's just carving, like sculpting in metal.
Yeah.
And that's what they do. And that's also why, to make your own engravers, if you want to do the Japanese style engraving, you have to make your own. There's no way around it. There's nothing that you can do, because they have, like a master engraver has between 250 and 300 gravers that he made throughout his life.
That's wild.
And each graver is for a very specific tool use, I mean. And yeah, that's it. It's a different story, yeah.
So why is missing scrolls then? Like, is it all because of the direction and like you have to kind of keep a continuous shape the whole way?
I think because we find it most beautiful or attractive.
Got it. Yeah.
You can go with the whole theory of like spirals.
Yeah.
I forgot how it's called. Like again, like we talked with the golden ratio. How is it called? Faraday? Not Faraday. Anyway, someone will know. like you have the golden spiral or whatever you want to call it. And it just, we see it everywhere in nature. So
yeah.
It's the most, somewhat in the most beautiful shape you can find. In a, so. It's just been refined over the years to become more and more good looking, I suppose.
Yeah. So before we started recording, you mentioned that there's not a lot of people, at least online, posting like videos on engraving, other than the folks that are like the master's edit. So how did you learn? Was it just trial and error for you?
Yeah, okay. Mostly. Even though I have to say, to comment what you say, that actually now, in the last year or so, you see more and more people start engraving. Like you said, Alex Steele started engraving, and this also exploded YouTube with engraving. Everybody starts to engrave ZH fabrication.
Yeah.
Like lots of people start like, hey, engraving maybe is not so difficult. I mean, it is difficult in a way, but it's also very, very simple.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. But to answer your actual question, lots of trial and error, lots of practice, lots of figuring out what am I doing wrong and looking more at other people's videos. There are some courses you can take, but I didn't. I don't know why. But, yeah.
If people are wanting to get into it, any good people you'd suggest they check out, other obviously than what you're doing?
So Sam Alfano is called. I think I pronounced it correctly. And Sam Alfano, yeah, A-L-F-O. I know. Yeah. Anyway, he has an online course about just about everything. Hand and chisel, air graver, scroll work, all of that. And I'm sure that's all you need to start engraving.
Gotcha. You said Sam, yeah, Alfano, master hand engraver. Yeah, cool. I'll include a link in the show notes for that. So as we're kind of wrapping up, are there like project ideas? You'd already mentioned the gold reduction, but is there stuff out there that you're excited to try?
I have so many ideas now. But now I'm just almost finishing a project about making your own art supply. So making your own brushes, your own paint, your own canvases or whatnot.
Cool. Yeah.
Also, I want to do, to start, like I said, kind of with the Japanese engraving. So I also want to do kind of a how to start Japanese engraving, and because it's in a way even cheaper than what you can do with hand engraving, like hand, gotcha, hammer and chisel engraving, right? Because this vise, all the rest is cheap. The vise is quite expensive. And so in Japanese one, the vise is kind of a bowl of metal and some pitch in it. So it's, yeah, so it's even more simple, I would say. And yeah, all sorts of inventions mostly. I want to make a lot of inventions more.
That's fun. The vise, did I see at one point you had basically just like a normal metal vise on a Lazy Susan for what you were using? Is that still what you use, or do you have like a, I guess, a proper one?
For the engraving, I have a proper one, a ball vise kind of.
Is that what they're called? Ball vises?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I've seen, how they're called online. They're just literally a ball and there's a vise on it.
Got it. Got it. That's,
and so you can turn it in every direction. But I bought like the knockoff one because the GRS are like crazy expensive.
Oh, really?
Like really crazy expensive. It's like an investment. And I'm like, if I were to be a master engraver and do that, you know, engraving, like what engravers, they engrave, I think, primarily guns or something like that. All the things they do in the States. So if I was that, I would probably buy a proper vise. But it's just, it's integrated with everything that I want to make. So that works really fine for me.
Yeah, that's sweet. Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time and chatting with us. Where, if people want to follow your stuff, is it on Instagram? Is that the best place you'd send people and YouTube?
Yeah, I only have Instagram and YouTube. That's where I, so just my name, I suppose, Uri Tuchman, and Uri Tuchman probably would not go far with most people, but Uri Tuchman, I guess. But yeah, YouTube and Instagram, and I have a how you would call it, a business mail, for inquiries, but it's on the YouTube page. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, people can snail mail you as well. That's funny. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Yeah. All right, thanks for hanging around to the end of the show. This is where I give you a quick update about the things I've got going on inside of my own shop over at the Make or Break shop over on YouTube. I've been cranking out the projects here recently, been doing one a week, which has been pretty neat. And so the one that I had come out this week, I talked about it, I believe last week, but I have done a wooden carving of Groot from the Avengers. He's the Guardians of the Galaxy. There is a pretty popular 3D model that folks will print out, and it doubles as a planter for flowers or whatever you want to put inside of a garden or an indoor garden or succulent. And so I saw that and I was like, it'd be really cool to actually turn this into a larger piece. And since I don't have a 3D printer, I was like, I could actually just carve this straight from wood. And Groot is made from wood anyways, so this could be a fun project. I have a cedar tree that fell in my yard a couple years ago from some storms that we had come through, and I took one of those pieces and carved it up, and the video is live, and it was really fun to do. It's the first time I'm ever doing any real like power carving, so I got a cheap power carving chain from Harbor Freight, which is a little bit sketchy, but it worked. And then I used a Dremel as well as some chisels to kind of do the face surfaces. And one technique that I've seen some people do, not quite in this way though, is so the whole shishugiban, or however you say it, where basically you burn the wood to give a protective coating. I did that, but then I sanded it back so it would add in detail to the different, especially like around the eyes and the mouth, to give it more pronounced features, so it would really stand out, as well as that's how I made the eyes black, because he actually has black eyes. But the whole process was a lot of fun, a pretty quick project to put together, and you guys can check that out. Again, links to everything that we talk about, if you did not know, are in the show notes. And if you guys are listening on Apple Podcasts or Overcast or a bunch of those that support chapters, there's usually chapters
for everything as well. So you guys can actually search through everything through the topics. But the next project I have coming up, I will not have a video out for it next week because I'm going to be traveling this weekend. But I am going to actually start construction on a swing that's going to double as an X-wing that my daughter will sit inside. I'm working on a 3D model for that right now. And I'll be starting construction. This was actually a project I wanted to do last summer. Never got around to it, but we'll actually start building it. Not totally sure how the thing's going to go together, but I still have this vision of seeing an X-wing hanging from our swing set in the backyard, which I think is going to be really neat. Also, this will be the last of my test month for the Make or Break Showcase, which is a weekly series where I'm highlighting projects from the maker community. And this will be, they come out usually on Saturdays. They're on Instagram TV, so IGTV, or I've been posting them to my stories as well to kind of see how they go. But I would love for you guys to check it out on my Instagram account at the Make or Break Shop. And moving forward, I think I am going to do it. So if you guys have anything you'd like to feature, a project, or somebody that you think is doing really cool stuff, then hit me up, let me know. I would love to feature it in the future. So until next time, go make or break something in your shop. See you guys.